This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, May 20th, 21 on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this hour, Governor Asa Hutchinson discusses the state and COVID-19 as an expiration date for the public health emergency declaration nears. And in just a few minutes, we continue our conversations with instructors leading sessions at the University of Arkansas Honors College Forum dedicated to vaccines. Today, how the U of A prepped for the process of giving shots to everybody in the campus community, from teenage students to faculty members in their 70s. After our show on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston, fighting between Hamas and Israel is the worst it's been since 2014. We get the backstory from an advisor to the U.S. State Department. That story, all the news you need to know and more on Here and Now, beginning at 1. The Arkansas Department of Health reports no new deaths from COVID-19 were recorded in the past 24 hours. 244 new cases of COVID-19 are being reported, though. That brings the total of new cases in the past 2 days of reporting to more than 500. Hospitalizations in Arkansas because of the virus remain the same, 188. The League of Women Voters of Arkansas and Arkansas United are filing a lawsuit challenging legislation passed this year by the Arkansas General Assembly. In a press release this morning, the groups write the new laws being challenged are restrictive voting laws intended to make it harder for eligible Arkansas voters to participate in state elections. The suit challenges laws that require signature checks between absentee ballots and signatures on voter registration applications, prohibit anyone from entering or remaining within 100 feet of a polling place, and other new rules. The lawsuit was filed in the Circuit Court of Pulaski County. Arkansas Congressman Steve Womack says the American people deserve to know the truth behind the events of January 6th. The 3rd District Congressman voted with 34 other Republicans in the U.S. House, including Arkansas Congressman French Hill, to establish a national commission to investigate the attack on the U.S. Capitol. In a statement, Congressman Womack says there are many unanswered questions, not the least of which, he says, are decisions from Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office regarding actionable intelligence ignored prior to the event. The measure passed in the House. It is not expected to pass in the U.S. Senate. Congressman Womack says he believes the structure of the commission is fair and transparent. Weather permitting, a few area high school teams will be playing for state championships today in Benton. The Van Buren baseball team scheduled to play for the 5A baseball title in about an hour. Springdale Harbor and Rogers will play each other for the 7A baseball title tonight. And the Greenwood softball team is playing in the 5A state championship game this afternoon at 4. All of the games will be carried live on Arkansas PBS. Baseball and softball championships continue through Sunday. Soccer state championships begin tomorrow. The Arkansas Razorback men's golf team advances to the NCAA championships. Arkansas finished second in the just-completed NCAA regional outside of Nashville, and with that finish, qualifies for the NCAA championship tournament beginning May 28th in Arizona. 80% chance of rain tonight, lows in the mid to upper 60s. Tomorrow, a 40% chance of showers, highs from the upper 70s to lower 80s. The Saturday and Sunday forecasts include slight chances of rain, with highs in the lower to mid 80s. Thursday, this is Ozarks at Large. This week, the University of Arkansas Honors College concludes its two-week forum dedicated to vaccines. The final session tomorrow concentrates on how the University of Arkansas prepared to vaccinate thousands of students, faculty, and staff. The session will be led by University of Arkansas Chancellor Joseph Steinmetz and Dr. Huda Sharaf, the medical director at Pat Walker Health Center at the University of Arkansas. She's also a board-certified internal medicine physician. Earlier this month, we reached both via Zoom to talk about the session and how the U of A has moved through an uncertain year. Chancellor Steinmetz says from the beginning of the pandemic, he wanted to make sure the right people got in the right conversations. And Dr. Sharaf says when the vaccinations first rolled out, demand outpaced available supply.
While we didn't have the vaccine initially, well, then it's our responsibility to this campus to make sure that there are resources available for them in the community to get the vaccine. And so we had groups that set aside time. They set aside dates for drive-through clinics specifically for university community members that were eligible in the phases at the time. We had outside pharmacy that held a mass clinic in our SEC club space in the stadium, again, through partnerships with the athletic department, and able to vaccinate hundreds upon hundreds of people in a matter of 4 to 6 hours. So while initially we ourselves did not have the physical vaccine in our health center, it's still our responsibility to connect with the medical community around us to ensure that we have those resources available for our campus.
Chancellor, you mentioned getting the right people around the table, whether literal or figuratively, during all of this. But what was the challenge about the messaging, because things change so quickly during a pandemic? You might hear this, or you might get that, or some new information might come down. I'm imagining if it wasn't a 24/7 obligation, it was close to try to figure this out.
Yes, I think that right from the beginning of this pandemic, if I'd sort of characterize the U of A community in general, I think there was more nervousness about the pandemic than you would see generally or in the population. And this was borne out in messaging that I got over the course of the last 13 months, where, within the span of 30 minutes, I could get an email from a parent saying that the whole pandemic was a hoax. And why are we wearing masks and trying all of the messaging that you're talking about? And then I'd hear from a faculty member who was afraid to come into the classroom, even though we had were masking and distancing and put up plexiglass and the other things that you're supposed to do. So what we tried to do is when the pandemic was at its height, I put out regular messages to the community that really summarized where we were, but kept delivering that message to follow the CDC and health department guidelines, because I think that would keep us safe as the campus. And what I want to really point out is our campus community did that. That our campus was safe, and that was, if you looked at any of the data that we posted, by the way, through transparency, we wanted also people to know on a couple of times a week how many active cases there were, who was in quarantine, the numbers there, as well as some other statistics. That was helpful in the messaging because it could people could look at it and know if we had a surge at the beginning of the year when the students first came. But after that point, we're relatively flat across the rest of the pandemic. But that information was constantly shared, and I think it helped calm the community down. And so the message was one of keep safe with the precautions, test, come in and test if you're in doubt or even if you want some reassurance. And then now we're into the vaccine. It's the same kind of message, is that we will remain a safe community when everybody is vaccinated. So everybody does that. So that's the absolutely the consistent messaging we're trying to put out there on a very regular basis.
You know, and Chancellor Simons, you would put out these statements and you would often remind people that the university is not an island to Fayetteville and Northwest Arkansas, that it has to work together.
Yeah, that's a great point, Kyle, because when I think about the community itself, when we just think about the students, about 80% of our students live off campus, with only 20%. And that number was even probably a bit more skewed this year because we allowed our freshmen to live in the community if they felt unsafe in the residence halls. We, as a university, we really have no control over that 80% or where they go and what they do if they go. And so the messaging had to keep reinforcing that fact that you're coming from us back and forth from what was a pretty lockdown safe environment to one that might not be so safe. I saw pictures from Dixon Street throughout the pandemic, for example, that really made me nervous. because I knew that wasn't going on campus, but there was very, very little that we could do. Now, the state and the governor stepped in, I think, limiting the hours down on Dixon Street was helpful, even though I feel sorry for the business owners themselves in this, but it helped keep us safe. But that was a consistent message, is for people, look out for each other, because you're actually not in that lockdown kind of very safe environment we created on campus. You're not there 24/7.
If you go back to December 2019 and January 2020, there was a move to make sure people had their MMR vaccinations. Remember that, when we thought that was the big movement? And I'm wondering.
I remember, Kyle.
I do too, because
yes.
the state of Kansas
yes.
would not send my records and I had to get revaccinated. And I'm just wondering if that very small effort in any way could translate to what happened a year or so later. Did that provide any sort of groundwork?
I'll let Huda follow up on this, because it certainly did. One of the things it did is some of the groups that I was talking about how to handle an epidemic or a pandemic was actually in place. And so it was very easy in a way to transition to the pandemic world just a couple of months after we were past there. But there's another, I think, a health angle to this that's maybe even more important.
We talk about that and just kind of the nature of the events, because the mumps outbreak on campus ended actually the end of February. And we had literally just created a communicable disease outbreak committee on campus. And so, you know, it was declared over the end of February, and then March comes along. But I agree with the chancellor. I mean, you know, again, we've had this longstanding working relationship with the Arkansas Department of Health. And so we had already been working with them for the prior several months in regards to the mumps outbreak and then giving, you know, MMR vaccine on our campus. And so when the pandemic hit, you know, we had been having discussions about mumps, and so we've just pretty much pivoted to COVID-19. And so I think it did prepare us. Now we look back on mumps and we're like, wow, that was nothing. So, you know, I mean, I don't mean to minimize the outbreak on our campus, but I had a friend of mine on campus that just bought me a coffee mug, and on the coffee mug, it says, "I miss mumps." And so it is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, I've said this and I'll say this again, you know, that it has been a very difficult, you know, year and so many months, but I think that all of us will come out much stronger after this. And so there are a few silver linings, obviously, through all of this, things that we've learned along the way. And so I hope this is my last pandemic in my lifetime. I truly do. But, you know, everything will be relative from this point forward. So
a couple more questions. What was the stress level of working in the unknown, especially perhaps before we knew we were going to get the vaccine when we did? And just, I think a lot of people have struggled with the idea that we don't know what's next in a week or 2 weeks or a month.
That's a great question. From my perspective, probably the last 12 or 14 months has introduced more uncertainty into higher education in general, and also surrounding the pandemic. And it's almost on two levels. One is the pandemic itself, where you talk about what is next week going to be like? Are the cases going up? Are they going down? Is the vaccine really going to be ready when people say it is? It's going to be ready in December. Now it's going to be ready in January. And so that uncertainty around the health issues surrounding the vaccine were great. But there's another whole level of angst that it created. And that was, what does that affect on our student recruiting? What is the effect on faculty mental health and our students' mental health and the stress levels that are around, that are being caused by the pandemic itself? What are the financial hits that we took because of having to deal with that? And then what is the effect, for example, of the CARES Act that we received and trying to mitigate some things? It all started for me, actually, at the SEC men's basketball tournament over in Nashville in, I don't even know what year it was now, probably March 2020. Yeah. I think that's when it was. And that was the first introduction to this total uncertainty, because as a group of chancellors and presidents, we were gathered there for our annual meeting, which we always have in that forum. And the only thing we discussed in the first hour is what to do with the whole athletics program that was going to follow. And nobody had any idea with certainty, is this a 1 month thing? Is this, is this a 6 months? I can guarantee you nobody thought it was a year long thing. And then the introduction of the campus things came like 2 hours after that initial meeting. I remember spending almost the whole morning with my chief of staff, Laura Jacobs, on the telephone, trying to figure out what we were going to do on campus, given that this had come on us pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So it has been an entire 12 to 14 months of just waiting for what's going to drop next, what's going to happen next.
And finally, because this was so stressful, you have to worry about the health, the mental health, the physical health of the people who work for you, the entire community. How did you make sure, whether it was at Pat Walker or whether it was in the administration building, that you and your colleagues were mindful of self-care and took care of yourselves and got enough rest if you could?
I'll let Huda start with Pat Walker, because this is a very stressed area of the university throughout this whole thing. They did a marvelous job. And I don't know how they managed it. So Huda can tell us how they managed it over there.
So by all means, thank you. So that's the one thing that also is a silver lining, is that we've learned about the resilience and strength and flexibility of our staff. So the first thing that we did, the very first thing we did, is start with risk mitigation processes in our clinic to ensure the safety of our staff and the patients. And so we did that from the get-go. And so that assisted a lot. We made sure, even though we did have a PPE shortage and the personal protective equipment shortage, again, through the rigorous searches of our nurse manager, through inquiries in the community and on campus, we ensured that we had a sufficient supply of gloves and gowns and masks and shields. And so that was the number one priority, is to keep everybody safe from getting COVID-19 on the job. Then after that, we had also initiated regular all-staff meetings, where we were basically doing updates twice a week. We were doing them on Monday mornings and Thursday mornings, and that involved entire medical staff, women's clinic, primary clinic, all support staff, lab, x-ray, you name it. And so we spearheaded those meetings, updating our staff as we went along on the pandemic. What are the new things that we're learning about COVID? You know, I remember way back when it started, they're like, no, masks aren't, you don't need to wear masks, right? And then it changed, like, everybody needs to be wearing that mask. And that's true. But, you know, it was that way. Every single day, I mean, a colleague of mine said, it's like we're building the plane as we fly it. Right. I mean, so every day is a new day. And so we have a responsibility to our teams to stay up to date on all the information and keep them safe. And then we pivoted to televisits and telemedicine for our patients, because a lot of them didn't want to come in the clinic. And those that are sick with symptoms consistent with COVID, not only do we need to keep patients protected from each other, we need to also protect our staff. And so, you know, we did our, and then we moved to do testing outside the building, because obviously ventilation is much better. Again, in attempts to protect our staff. I can sit here today and proudly state that we have not interrupted medical care for the community since the pandemic began. We have over 50 medical staff members, and we have not had a single member of our medical teams contract COVID from the workplace. And we have open door policies here. And so, you know, I'm always reiterating that. So is our clinic manager, our nurse manager, is that, you know, if they have any questions, any concerns, any worries, they need to come and see us. We try to remain as approachable and as accessible as possible. And so I think through a lot of those efforts, we've maintained a cohesive, healthy team. I'm very thankful for that. Very thankful.
Kyle, for the rest of the university, really, there were so many sources of stress, some due to the change in the way work was being done or students were studying. When we went remote, that caused a wave of issues that we tried to deal with, in the sense of trying to make it as easy as we could for faculty to make that transition to that remote environment. That caused a lot of stress. I know this firsthand. I was teaching a course that semester when we shifted on the very early part of it. And then throughout the pandemic, there were other sources of stress. When people got used to working remote, I don't think that was the issue as much as it was, how am I going to take care of my family? And things that were not directly related, I think, to the university's function, but to the function of each one of our members of the university community. So we did recommend and really spend a lot of time making sure that there were mental health assistance available for anyone who needed it, faculty, staff, or students. Again, that's from over in the Pat Walker Health Center. That was done. It was actually taken advantage of by, we know that from the visits and the numbers of people that were there. So I think that helped to mitigate that stress level, but it didn't go away. And then we often forget, though, that our faculty in particular and our staff members have careers that have a trajectory towards them as they move, particularly for our faculty, as they move through the ranks. There's a lot of stress also about how to deal with the fact that my research program is not going so well because I'm home, I'm not in the lab, I don't have access to the libraries in Europe to finish my work. And so there were some policy changes that were done to help mitigate that stress as well by adding a couple of years to the tenure clock for our untenured faculty, so they made sure that they had this opportunity to catch up. And the stress is back. It is the stress of returning to campus. And that's what we're dealing with now. And it's on us, I think, to demonstrate the campus is safe and to help people make that transition back to campus. And the last group I'll talk about, I'm very concerned about our next year's sophomore class. They're going to come into an environment and have no idea what the university is really like and what university life is. We have all kinds of things for freshmen to get them oriented to the campus. We've got to pay attention, I think, to the mental health and the stress levels of our sophomores as they make a transition. So there's a lot of work being planned in student affairs right now to help with that transition.
University of Arkansas Chancellor Joe Steinmetz and Dr. Huda Sharaf, the medical director at the Pat Walker Health Center at the U of A, will lead the final session of the university's Honor College Forum dedicated to vaccines. We talked with both via Zoom earlier this month in advance of their session. Each of the forum discussions, by the way, available for free to the public. You can go to the University of Arkansas Honors College YouTube page to find those discussions.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The University of Arkansas at Fort Smith offers students more than a diploma. UAFS offers students a resume, putting knowledge to work since 1928. UAFSLions.org for more information. Every day is an adventure at the Scott Family Amazium in Bentonville. With over 40 hands-on, interactive experiences, curious children can explore the arts and sciences all summer long. Summer camps held at the Jones Center in Springdale and Bentonville Community Center. Amazium.org for more information.
Arkansas's public emergency status will be allowed to expire on May 30th. Governor Asa Hutchinson made the announcement during a press briefing this morning in Little Rock.
The reason that we're ending the public health emergency declaration is that everybody in Arkansas knows what to do. Our hospitalizations are down. Every adult in Arkansas, in fact, 12 plus years of age, have access to vaccines that we did not have access before. Everyone knows what to do. It is not an emergency. It is a maintenance of effort in terms of our vaccines and managing the pandemic.
The governor says many of his emergency orders, including those involving telemedicine, have been enacted into law, so those orders are not dependent on a public health emergency declaration continuing. The governor says it is important to understand the state is still in a pandemic.
The fact that I am ending the declaration of a public health emergency does not change the fact that we still have the COVID-19 virus in our community. It does not change the fact that our public health system has to continue to deal with it. It doesn't change the fact that we need to continue to get vaccinations out. We can do this in terms of a long-term maintenance of effort, and it is not necessary to have the emergency declaration to carry out this public health responsibility.
The governor says taking the virus seriously and getting vaccinated remains incredibly important. He says the state has a $6.4 million ad campaign to encourage the public to receive vaccinations. Another $2 million campaign will be directly focused on underserved populations to encourage vaccinations. The governor showed a pair of ads this morning that are part of the campaign, one featuring former Arkansas Razorback and NBA basketball star Sidney Moncrief.
Hello, my name is Sidney Moncrief. I've taken over 10,000 shots during my career. And one of them is the COVID-19 vaccine.
The other advertisement features small business owners in places like Bald Knob and Helena, West Helena, explaining why they received their shot. To further incentivize vaccinations, the governor is authorizing a bonus to certain Arkansans who receive a shot.
We're going to give a $100 bonus for executive branch state agency employees who have received at least one COVID-19 vaccination. Now, when I say it's $100, that's net to them, so it's really going to be a $200 bonus, but with the holding taxes, we wanted them to get at least $100 in their hand.
That's more than 25,000 eligible employees, including those who may have already received a vaccination. If that pool of state employees reaches a 75% vaccination rate, the bonus program will cost Arkansas about $3.6 million. The money will be initially absorbed by the affected agencies in budgetary personnel costs, and the governor says the money will hopefully then be reimbursed by funds included in the American Rescue Plan. This morning's entire briefing can be viewed at the governor's YouTube page.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. You may have heard Arkansas has a governor's race coming up in 2022. Candidates already are raising money, collecting endorsements, and jockeying for position. Names you know, like former White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, have declared for the Republican nomination. On the Democratic side, there are three lesser-known candidates who have officially announced their entry into the race. One of them is James Russ Russell, a 48-year-old small business owner from Little Rock. On the program today, Roby Brock catches up with Russell to find out more about his campaign, why he's running, and what he sees as his path to becoming the state's 47th governor. That's after the break on this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
In February this year, James Russ Russell, a political newcomer, announced he would seek the Democratic nomination for Arkansas governor in 2022. He and his wife run New Dawn Counseling. That's an outpatient mental health clinic in Little Rock. Claiming he was frustrated by leadership following the state's COVID-19 response and motivated by the social justice protests of last summer. Russell said he is determined to help. Russell is one of three Democratic candidates who have announced for the governor's office, joining Anthony Bland and Supa Cypressith Mays. In a recent interview, Roby Brock spoke with Russell about his campaign.
Well, tell me, why did you jump in this race, and what has been some of the reaction you've received since you made your announcement in February?
The reasons that I jumped in, probably too long to list within the time frame we've got, mainly just a systemic failure of leadership within our state to actually stand up for the people and to take into consideration compassion when, you know, passing laws and governing. And so far, the reaction that I've had, which, brief aside, we did hit our 100th day of the campaign on April 30th, so we passed that mile mark. The reception has actually been almost universally positive. A lot, especially of the younger voters, have been very excited and very enthusiastic. Some of the older ones are surprised to hear someone that's outspoken, but are also very receptive and happy to hear someone willing to get out there and speak the truth and not worry about it. So
I know you'll have a lot of goals and you have a lot of campaign issues that you are on your website there. Tell me maybe the top two or three things you would hope to accomplish if you were elected governor.
Top easy is education reform. We actually have to take a look at our budget and reinvest in what we're doing with education, and not simply from a pre-K through 12th grade standpoint, but also in worker re-education as adults, in trade schools, in availability of adult learning. Of course, in the history, we had the No Child Left Behind policy, which unfortunately left a lot of adults behind. So we just really need to look back and reinvest and make sure, because everything else that we have in our society is fundamentally based on the principle of having an educated populace that can engage with the topics and with society as a whole. So the need to provide a solid education, make sure teachers have the resources they need, make sure the students have access to food, have the tools that they need, the paper, pens, whatever it may be. It's really making sure that we've got that in line and we bring it up, because we rank near or at the bottom in the nation for education, and that should be an embarrassment to us. We've got to fix it.
All right. The state legislature just kind of wrapped up their regular session business. They're in recess. They'll come back later in the year and deal with, I think, tax reform and redistricting, if not a few other things. I don't have a whole 3 days to talk about this, but I will let you talk to me about what you think was the one maybe best thing that they accomplished this legislative session, and what was the one worst thing in your eyes in this session?
If I can get a little bit sideways on it, I actually think that the same answer, both of them have the same answer. It, rather than parsing out any individual bill or piece of legislation that got passed, I think that the worst thing that came out of it was seeing the evidence of who our legislators are and what they're pushing forth, the regressive policies, the voter suppression, the denial of rights to women, just in general, the fulmination of the message they were sending to the voting populace and to the rest of the country is who we are. However, I also think that that's possibly the best thing to come out of it, because that has engendered such urgency within those people paying attention for the need to reclaim and get engaged and turn out the vote, boost voter registration totals, and actually get back into society and become engaged with our civic process. So I think that is kind of a double-edged sword, in that it was incredibly traumatic to go through, but hopefully we emerge on the other side as a better and stronger Arkansas.
I don't have to tell you, you're starting from ground zero with political experience in this campaign. And Republicans do have an advantage electorally if you just look at recent election cycles and polling data right now in Arkansas. Maybe explain to me how you think you will win the Democratic nomination, and how, if you did, how would you win in the fall of 2022 in the general election?
I think that honestly, not having that much experience, it's not a matter of not having that much experience politically or being uninformed politically. It's not having a name brand. I don't have name brand recognition, which is different. And that's what our politics have shifted over to. I have the advantage of not having a brand that I have to defend. I can get out there and be outspoken. I can get out there and say, no, this is not fake news. The election wasn't stolen. I can stand, I hate to use the term, I can stand my ground on an issue and say, no, this is where we've drawn the line. This is our value. And I hope that appeals to Democratic voters who have felt left behind or like we aren't fighting hard enough, where we need to actually push forward and have our voice and control that narrative instead of being reactionary.
And that is James Russ Russell, who is seeking the Democratic nomination for Arkansas governor in 2022. We will, of course, be following the state and local election season all the way through to election night in November 2022. And you can keep up with that coverage at nwabusinessjournal.com and our sister website, talkbusiness.net. And speaking of election season, Washington County Judge Joseph Wood says he will seek the Republican nomination for Arkansas Lieutenant Governor in 2022. The GOP primary for Lieutenant Governor is already a crowded field. State Senator Jason Rapert, Arkansas Surgeon General Greg Bledsoe, and former state GOP Chairman Doyle Webb have all announced their candidacies for that job. On Tuesday, Walmart reported earnings for the fiscal first quarter, and the numbers underscored CEO Doug McMillon's optimism. The retailer benefited from higher in-store traffic and stimulus spending in the first quarter and grew revenue to $138.3 billion. That's up 2.7% from a year ago. McMillon said in a call with analysts after the earnings report that his optimism is higher than it was at the beginning of the year, and that in the United States, customers clearly want to get out and shop. And analysts are anticipating that America's Car-Mart will report increased revenue and profit in its quarterly earnings call. The Buy Here, Pay Here used car dealer in Rogers is expected to report fourth quarter earnings after the markets close next Tuesday. I'm Paul Gatling, and that is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas is getting closer, slowly, to at least half of the population 16 and older having at least partial vaccination against COVID-19. As of yesterday afternoon, the Arkansas Department of Health reports 36% of Arkansans 16 and older are fully immunized, just more than 10% partially immunized against the virus. Now, there are several opportunities in the next few days to receive a shot. Tomorrow, the Northwest Arkansas Council will host a Pfizer vaccine clinic at the J.B. Hunt headquarters in Lowell. This is for those 12 and older. Second shots also for those who've had a first Pfizer shot more than 21 days before tomorrow. The Bella Vista Fire Department will host a Pfizer vaccine clinic at the Bella Vista Farmers Market Sunday from 9 until 2. The market is at 606 West Lancashire Boulevard. Vaccinations open to anyone 12 and older. Parental consent is required for anyone under the age of 16. This, again, a Pfizer vaccination clinic, so second Pfizer shots available for anybody who had the first Pfizer shot at least 21 days before the Bella Vista clinic takes place on Sunday. Tuesday, there will be a Pfizer clinic at the Northwest Arkansas Community College in the Student Center in Bentonville. That's Tuesday from 8 until 1. That Tuesday clinic, again, for people 12 and older. Now, that's not all the clinics in our listening area. The good news is there is a hotline available from 8 to 6, Monday through Friday, that gives free help to schedule a vaccine. That hotline number, 800-985-6030. 800-985-6030. We'll repeat that number again at the end of today's show.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. We opened our segment today with the Dover Quartet live from the Walton Art Center in a concert offered on May 18th and shared with our Northwest Arkansas community through KUAF 91.3. For 9 years, the Dover Quartet has served as a resident ensemble for the Artosphere Festival Orchestra. This year, the four amazing musicians, Brian Lee, Joel Link, Milena Pájaro von der Stadt, and Camden Shaw, returned to our area for this special performance, offering a program that included pieces by William Grant Steele, Felix Mendelssohn, and Antonin Dvorak. KUAF's general manager Lee Wood and I had the fortune to be in this concert as we brought this experience to your living room through the magic of radio. I do not have enough words to describe this experience in which high-level musicianship met passion in an event that also offered an opportunity to build community and let healing happen in our post-pandemic world. We were especially moved by the inclusion in the program of a piece by William Grant Steele, African-American composer born in Mississippi who grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas. The Dover Quartet started the concert with William Grant Steele's Lyric Quartet, a piece composed in 1960, subtitled Musical Portraits of Three Friends.
Thank you.
The Dover Quartet was back to our area, and we at KUAF 91.3 partner with the Walton Arts Center for a special live performance for Northwest Arkansas audiences, the ones seated at Bon Walker Hall and those tuning in from their living rooms. We all, Arkansas residents, Arkansas born, Arkansas raised, felt a sense of pride and representation to see William Grant Steele in the program, along with the well-known composers from the so-called classical tradition, Mendelssohn and Dvorak. Lee and I spoke during the broadcast and in between of the power and the role of the arts as the great equalizers. We are super excited to see ensembles like the Dover Quartet and organizations like the Walton Arts Center using their platforms intentionally to bring marginalized and disenfranchised voices to the forefront, especially as we continue healing and allowing transformation after the racial reckoning prompted by the murder of George Floyd last summer. We close Sound Perimeter today with an excerpt from the last movement of Grant Steele's lyric quartet, The Jovial One, performed live at the Walton Arts Center and share with our listeners through KUAF 91.3. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
On tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, applications are now open for the new Arkansas Rent Relief Program.
We feel like we're off to a really strong start, but the challenge will be to keep that going and make sure that we get the word out and that everybody who is eligible for this knows about it. Because we don't want somebody who can get these funds to not apply just because they weren't aware of it.
Details on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. 91.3 KUAF. Also available later in the day at OzarksAtLarge.com and available on your schedule if you subscribe to the free daily Ozarks at Large podcast. You can sign up at KUAF.com or through any of the major podcast distributors.
Topics that have been discussed so far in the KUAF podcast series, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, are the successes and obstacles of past integrated anti-racist movements, the progress that can be made through working class solidarity and diverse voting coalitions. And now we're discussing the immense wealth gap between white and black Americans.
The amount of resources that would be required to bring black businesses in even the striking distance of the scale and sustainability of white-owned enterprises is perhaps too staggering to conceive.
Episode 4 of The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, is available now at KUAF.com and anywhere you get your podcasts.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Decatur. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF, and KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Once again, the vaccination hotline in Arkansas to receive help setting up a shot, 1-800-985-3060. 800-985-3060. Before we go, a consideration of language. Monday, toward the end of my conversation with Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, I recommended a trip to the World War II Japanese American Internment Camp Museum in McGee, south of Pine Bluff. A listener pointed out that the places in Roar and Jerome, Arkansas, where American citizens were taken merely because of their ancestry, were by definition more accurately concentration camps, complete with barbed wire. The museum, which officially uses the term internment in its title, does use the term concentration camps in the literature inside the museum. Thanks for listening closely and sending those comments. Keep them coming, please. Oh, and a correction. Earlier this week, I said William Grant Still, the composer, was a native Arkansan. Not quite. He was born in Mississippi, but after his father died when William was a baby, his mother moved with him to Little Rock, where he grew up. So, not technically a native. Today's edition of Ozarks at Large was produced by Timothy Dennis. Contributors today included Leah Uribe. Timothy Dennis, by the way, also produced today's Sound Perimeter. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling, produced by Stephanie Brock, and part of our continuing partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. Tomorrow, Ozarks at Large at noon and 7. Also tomorrow, on Science Friday on KUAF, it feels as though the U.S. has turned a corner in the COVID-19 pandemic. But it won't be over until the rest of the world has equitable access to vaccines. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for an inside look into the massive effort to vaccinate the globe. Plus, the launch angle revolution in baseball and a trial of opioid distributors. All of that and more on tomorrow's Science Friday from 1 to 3 on KUAF 91.3. From everyone that works on Ozarks at Large and at KUAF, thanks again for your continued attention and your continued support. We do appreciate it. Please take care of yourself. Get rest when you can. We'll talk again tomorrow. I'm Kyle Kellums.